the best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.
Another edition of Agribusiness.
Morning, Trinidad and Tobago. Thank you for being here another Thursday. Agribusiness Innovation, always on Freedom 106.5 FM. Joining us today, I have Mr. Baldath Faraj, and he has a guest with him as well, Ms. Karina Suku. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, and thanks for having me.
Karina, are you with us? All right, Karina, as we go along, feel free to jump into the conversation right now. We're not hearing you yet, but of course, pop in as we go along. So, Mr. Faraj, for those who may not be as familiar, could you please introduce yourself to our listeners?
Well, my name is Baldath Faraj. I'm the president of the Chaguanas Chamber of Commerce. I have been there since 2023, joined the board about 14 years ago. And, you know, eventually got to this position when Mr. Richie Sukai departed and went on to join the politics. So I have been there from then until now, until the expiration of my term sometime next year.
And could you please introduce yourself to our listeners?
I assume she might be having some connectivity issues, but she has joined. And just let me say that Karina is on our SME committee, and they focus on small businesses in Chaguanas. She also focuses on training and development and so on. And she has been on the board for the last year. And, you know, she's the ideal person to talk, to join in with me regarding SMEs and agriculture.
Thank you so much. So let's jump straight into the conversation then. The U.S. recently introduced new tariffs that are affecting Trinidad and Tobago. So how significant is this really for the country and specifically into agriculture and agro-processing sectors? I mean, what concerns you the most?
My concern really is, well, it's twofold. It's on the input side, because we import some raw material. We import packaging and so on from the U.S., and those obviously will be at a higher price because they would enter the U.S. from another country, and there would be tariff on those. So on the input side, there will be a nominal cost. But for our goods entering the U.S., that's the major concern. So that everything that goes into the U.S., that's where the 10% surcharge or the tariff comes in. Luckily, you know, we sell mainly to the diaspora, so that the impact might not be as significant. But, you know, it's definitely something that we need to look at very closely. Tariffs change from time to time, so that we may need to look at, you know, being a lot more competitive and so on, if we are to compete globally. But that has been on the drawing board for a long time, whether there is tariff or not. But, you know, the immediate thing really is the cost of our inputs, as well as when we export, there's an additional 10% that will be added on by the purchasers, well, to the retail market in the U.S.
Now, when we hear the term tariffs, we always see it as a threat. Are there instead any opportunities for our local manufacturers to become more competitive or even diversify into new export markets?
That has been a conversation for quite a while. And the mandate of the Ministry of Trade at our meeting, at the several meetings that we had, is to increase exports by, well, non-energy exports by $2 billion in the next couple of years, and by 2030 to take that to $5 billion U.S., so that has been a conversation. In terms of the opportunities, what I can say is that we have some of the exports that we really haven't made full use of. It's things like cocoa, hot sauces, and those products are less sensitive to the tariffs. And more than that, once we have external pressures, we start to innovate. We start to look at our supply chain. We start to look at the things, the little things that cost us money. And we start to reduce the cost for inputs. We start to look at reducing waste as well. And, you know, as we look at energy, for example, a lot of people going into solar energy and we can conserve energy as much as we can. Apart from that, you know, once we do a full audit and we look at those inputs, chances are that we will, in fact, reduce production costs. Whilst we might be doing that to continue our export to the U.S., the end result being, when the tariff comes off, if it does, we will still be a lot more competitive. And there's a huge market within CARICOM. I operate within CARICOM, most of the Eastern Caribbean. And what I can tell you is that when I go to those supermarkets in CARICOM, a lot of those goods, the processed goods especially, originate from Trinidad. So that CARICOM has been, to a certain extent, underutilized. But because there's no tariff by those countries and the agreement we have with CARICOM, it makes it so much more attractive. And that, too, is another huge market that is waiting to be further tapped into. We do have a lot of businessmen who are already in there, but I can tell you there's a lot of opportunities within CARICOM. The population of CARICOM mainstream, that's excluding Haiti and DR and those countries, probably is in excess of 5 billion people. You know, and they have purchasing power, they have foreign exchange to buy our goods, and the opportunities there is limitless, in my opinion. That's the opportunities, really, that we will see based on the new tariff. And, you know, when we have issues like those, that is when we innovate a lot more. And that's when we try as hard as possible to survive. And that actually gives us the slight edge.
Harina, you're with us?
Yes, I'm here. Good morning, everyone. Nice to be here on this panel this morning. And I could just jump in and add in terms of the opportunities for agri-processors in Trinidad and Tobago, we can look at the operational efficiency side of things internally. How do these agro-processors actually work, actually run their businesses? You know, with a possible increased cost, the tariff could actually create the incentive to improve productivity, looking at wastage. How is that managed? Automating processes is another way. Of course, there's a cost attached to it, but when we have to look at what are the advantages in terms of tax breaks or so, or even government support to be able to automate processes. And Ballard would have mentioned strengthening the supply chain management locally. How do these agri-processors collaborate locally at the local level? What needs to be improved in terms of their branding, certification, if they need to have their products certified so that you can be ready for exporting at some point in time. And then the general overview in terms of how is this business really sustainable into the future. So I think it gives the opportunity here also is available for businesses to look at their internal operations.
Now, if you were to advise SMEs about, or even exporters, about how they should be responding to these new tariffs, what are some of the things they would say?
How should they be responding to the new tariffs? Well, first of all, yes, there is a cost element involved, definitely. I would say to look at the other opportunities that's available, CARICOM, to be able to see, okay, how is your product positioned presently locally, and then in the wider Caribbean region. So that Ballard would have mentioned going into the CARICOM regions and then participating as a purchaser, and then you will see items from Trinidad. Okay, so is there something that like a program or so that we can develop where we can help persons who would like to export into the Caribbean to actually have some sort of support system, like an incubator system, where they can have that level of readiness, because I don't think it happens just like that, because businesses need information. And I think it would be really impactful if we could have those who are already in the process, like let's say within the Caribbean market, how can they, you know, like provide that support or give some sort of, you know, input in terms of those who would like to actually export their products.
So Mr. Maraj, have any input on that one?
I think Karina covered, you know, a lot of it. So I'm okay with it so far.
And if I can add also, the branding aspect of it is important, because sometimes, you know, the agri-processors are so focused on the operational side of things. You know, we need to get the products out there, but are they actually focusing on the whole aspect of branding and positioning? How is their product positioned? And I always say, first of all, locally, how is it positioned locally? And is the business or is the product and by extension, the brand ready to go out there and extension into the Caribbean market?
Now, something that's a little bit more difficult. We import so much food into Trinidad that we are susceptible to even the smallest supply shocks that happen.
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe that this current global trade environment is a wake-up call for us to accelerate food security?
Well, Jody, we have been talking a long time. I can't measure the number of years that we have been talking about food security. And up comes an oil boom, or up comes some war or something that increases the prices of our energy products and downstream as well. And then we forget about agriculture. We forget about food security. And similar to what happened with COVID, we started to innovate quickly. The entire world, I came from the banking sector, and things that we never did or never considered doing, we had to do it, and it worked well. So, you know, whenever we have shocks like these, it causes us to innovate and it creates opportunities. Now, I can tell you, we in Trinidad, we are very creative. We have done, I mean, we punch harder than our weight. In reality, you would know what Trinidadians do globally. And we have quite a lot of success stories. So I have no doubt in my mind that, and I hope that the support system that, as Karina spoke about, you know, could continue, and we could, you know, it's important then that for us to get where we want, there has to be, and later on in the conversation, we will talk about some of the support system that we would like to see, but you know, spot on, we need to look at food security, and now is the right time. And I mean, government come and go, but the Ministry of Agriculture should have one position for our food security systems, and we shouldn't change position from one government to the next. How often do we hear about Premier Larceny's squad, for example? Probably every budget. I'm not knocking anybody here, but those are some of the pain points. But, you know, to come back to the original question, how do we really create that level of food security? And what do we do? And those are some really, really important questions as the discussion go. You know, we have some suggestions as well that we could add to it. But really, really important. And I think that conversation should continue. And we should look for as much support as we can to ensure that we have food security. Now, we have to bear in mind that we really can't grow everything. But in the fullness of time, we will be able to reduce our food import bill and by increasing what we produce here locally. And one of the things that really, really comes to mind is the migrant population. They're looking for work. They are properly registered, some of them, but it's still here. And instead of dancing on tables and bars, why can't we look at something that is stable, something that produces more for us at a competitive price, and that will assist in more so in agriculture and exporting and things like that? Those are some of the questions, some of the things that comes to mind, you know, that we could consider, you know. And that would help with food security once we have proper setup of our farms. And of course, we'll also talk about technology as we go down the road. But, you know, really, really important. There has to be a quantum leap right now that doesn't cost us anything really if we are to support the existing farmers and to create new farmers coming out from the educational institute and so on to increase our production. I see too much. I go on the Karakum jetty from time to time, probably every week. And you will be surprised to know the amount of good that comes in from Karakum country that we grow here as well.
That is a lot of it. Now, what about bureaucracies right now? Have your members been expressing bottlenecks that they believe are preventing them from adapting and growing further?
This too is a sore point, but the port has been a constant area of, I mean, your goods have to come through the port, whether it's machinery, raw material. We import most of the things in Trinidad. I'll just share an experience I have. I have a container on port for 2 weeks now. Documents was presented before the goods entered Trinidad. Everything was in order. It's still on the port, and I have to pay extra rent. Manufacturers in Chaguanas who visit us from time to time have the same issues. That has been with us, plaguing us for a long time. So when you look at the razor thin profitability that we have to deal with, the less time we lose on port, the less money we lose on port because we have to pay rent and a host of other fees. That's one of the things that's preventing, those who are into agriculture from being competitive, you know? So that if we look at those companies that import, let's say, fertilizers and so on, and different chemicals for agriculture, I mean, I came from the banking sector. Whilst they got some level of preference, it was always a backlog in terms of the foreign exchange that they need to buy chemicals to grow our products. So that's another issue there. And yes, I agree that the government don't have enough foreign exchange, but it's difficult for those people to even predict. Because if you buy a container for, let's say, $30,000 US, and you pay 30% down, which is the common thing, and by the time that container gets here, you can't get the other 70%, and you don't know when you'll get it. That's another issue that, you know, people face. And there are shortages sometimes for some of those basic things. And more than that, it drives up the price because local importers has to go to the black market. They have to use credit card with PayPal charges that takes the price, the conversion higher. And, you know, the end result being that, you know, we do have the slight edge. We are not competitive enough. I mean, all we need to do is shave off 2 or 3% or 5% from our input cost and the time that it takes. And I mean, that should take us where we actually want to. There has been discussions with us almost every meeting that we have about the ease of doing business. Yes, it will take time, but that's something that we need to really do quickly. I just want to share one more thing. I do business too in the Caribbean. And I do payroll, I pay my taxes and my national insurance and those things. And they are so much more up to date than us. And you would think that we should really be leading in that area. But I can sit here and work and do everything without visiting an office. I can't say the same thing for here. So those are some of the bottlenecks that I wish we could deal with, and we could deal with quickly and decisively.
Mm-hmm. Now, Ms. Suku, I want to get this next question to you. In that many of the smaller SMEs often find difficulties in getting into places like supermarkets or hotels or even export markets, what changes do you think would allow some of these SMEs to become part of larger value chains?
Okay.
Okay, great question.
Jody, forgive me. I just want to interject a little bit. Why? Because the CEO of Extra Foods is on our board, and we had a brief chat this morning. And that was the very discussion that we had. So Karina will chime in after. But just to share, of course, those hotels and the top supermarkets, they are standards. And in order to ensure that they protect their consumers and they have quality produce, they have to visit the farms. They have to be approved. He told me this morning that there are some farmers that use kerosene on their products to increase the shelf life and so on. Now, those are not things that the hotel industry will go for. Neither would the supermarkets or the ones that really look at quality. And there are quite a lot of things. So my short answer to you is that those farmers should get in touch with some of the larger supermarkets, see what their standards are, see what type of consistent quality and pricing that those supermarkets looking for. Mm-hmm. And most important, let the Ministry of Agriculture find a database that NAMDEVCO attempted to do so that we would not have an overproduction of one and an underproduction of the other. What happens is that farmers lose money when they overproduce one particular good because the price is, you know, is a supply and demand. So, that's just my small input, and I'll let Karina go ahead. But I just thought I should share some real life examples regarding what we deal with today.
Great. Thanks, Marlott. And to be a part of the greater value chain in this entire agro-processing framework, it's really important, first of all, that these SMEs understand what are the requirements. So I think maybe it may be a little bit in terms of questioning the ease of doing business, even as an agro-processor. How easy is it? You have to go to the Ministry of Health, Ministry of Agriculture. There are many forms of documentation that are required, interacting with other regulatory bodies. I don't know that we do have a space where maybe agro-processors can go and actually get all of the information that's ready for them. Because I feel, Jody, sometimes it could be, you know, just the lack of information, like not knowing what to do, where and when and how. And Balat also brought an important point. I think the standard operating procedures of agro-processing businesses, it really needs to be directly related to the business, yes, and honest production, you know, like honestly do your business. So in terms of using kerosene and all of those things, is it more about the dollar or the value that you want to add to the value chain? So I feel like really helping these agro-processors to understand the importance of doing business in a way that is compliant and also safe. So that, remember, part of this whole process too is the whole idea of trust building, you know, That's why I mentioned branding. So that's an important part in the whole branding scenario, where companies can really promote, okay, this is my production process. And I feel having consumers buy into it and really being able to validate it and say, yes, I trust this brand. I think that is a very, very important in terms of helping them to operate in the value chain.
And what one of the things that I always see is that taking a step back into primary producers, we oftentimes have issues with middlemen, people who go into the fields and buy, but they are the ones who oftentimes aggregate product and then would supply in bulk to stores. So they do have a role in there, because most of the times, many of these large establishments, they don't want to buy a product and have to have invoicing and these procedures for 20 different persons. They'd rather buy from one. Mm-hmm. It makes everything cleaner. So so the models that could exist where things could be aggregated and then supplied, I think that is something that's worth exploring.
Definitely. Again, the access to information, you know, so you're going to different places. So I mentioned like maybe Ministry of Health, Ministry of Agriculture, you know, if like a coming together, a collaborative advantage where these agri-processors can actually get the information and they can see, you know, like be able to do their own SWOT and say, okay, well, oh yeah, it's okay. So this is where my weaknesses lie and this is where my strengths are. So then I can move forward, you know? I think the focus, you know, is really to look at the business internally. How am I actually operating? Is it on standard, off standard, you know?
From the members that you represent, do you find that there is an openness to embrace technology? I mean, there is so much talk about AI and all these different types of automations and even data analytics. Mm-hmm. You see them adapting, and do you think that it's going to have a big impact over the next decade?
Most certainly. In terms of the actual implementation of AI in your business, I mean, even from a fundamental level, administratively, and then incorporating it in your operational process, I think it's a necessity. I don't think it's something to think about. It's something that, let's see how we can implement this in our business, even from a very basic level, if you know what I mean, a very basic level. Because I have worked with some SMEs where they would have come in for funding and it was because their process was high. It was manual. You know, they were doing everything, you know, by hand and packaging, and it became so much because of the demand for their product and the introduction of technology. So they'd have gone out there and look at the machinery and bought in the information, received the funding and all of that. And they would have reported the improvements in their production. So I think it's definitely the way to go, and it's something that it should definitely be adopted. So a lot of persons want to go by, okay, you know, I don't trust this. I don't want to do that. But it's happening at a national level. So then definitely, I think it would be something that businesses should look at. Paula, go ahead.
If I may jump in, Jody, sometime, probably just above a year ago, the chamber was approached by a foreign company who actually supplies goods, agricultural produce to the U.S., and what they offered to us is drone technology, so that the average farm, you might have, let's say, an unpredictable yield. But with this type of farming, what they do, it's done in greenhouses, and it, you know, it's not manned. You probably need somebody to go into the farm once a week. But what they have is drone technology, and that drone flies 24/7 around the entire farm. That would pinpoint every tree that is lacking in nutrients, and you might need some additional chemical and whatever have you, so that in terms of the yield, it would have been significantly higher than open field farming, one. And two, you know, you don't have trees dying and you don't know why. The drone could actually, you know, scan the entire farm and tell which tree need nutrient, and it would supply it with that nutrient. And, you know, it was amazing to us, because the deal was 90% of the products, of the produce, will be exported back to the U.S. and will be made with foreign currency. So I think, to answer your question regarding AI, and when you look at the cost of labor, I mean, it's a high investment, initial investment, mm-hmm. but what this would actually do, this type of farming, is probably wipe out a lot of those smaller farmers. And that's not something that we wanted to happen. But I can tell you, I'm sure as ice is cold and going forward, that type of farming will be introduced. Because if you could get 5-10 times more yield per acre than open field farming, and then the labor is very nominal, and then you could then predict, because the weather doesn't affect it, it's actually in greenhouses. You know, I would say in the next few years, that may or may not take over the actual farming industry. And what is good is that the amount of land you need is not as you would need for open field, and the type of produce they were looking at is tomato and mixed vegetables.
That's quite interesting. You know, we had some guests on the show as well that had similar technology where they were instituting it in California and they would have irrigation on plants specifically, and satellites would fly over, read the fields, and automatically add irrigation to certain plants where needed. And I think that, I mean, it's still relatively new technology, but it's definitely something where I see the world is going in the future, because I have a farm in Tortuga, and I would tell you sometimes there's only so much water you can store. I get water every 14 days. You know, so it is a challenge trying to use things as carefully as possible.
You know, one of the things I notice as well, when we talk to farmers, a lot of those farmers, sometimes they tell you, I like corn and peas and we could intercrop and so on and so on. You don't hear much of them talking about getting the Ministry of Agriculture to do a soil test to tell us what will best grow in Felicity, what would best grow in Charleville, and that sort of thing. You know, so we're still a little bit backward as it relates to farming. Yes, we have some people doing it, but a lot of them that we spoke to, you know, they plant the things that they like. So it's not really a business. It's more like a love for farming. Mm-hmm. And those are some of the things that I think the ministry should advertise and provide free soil testing so that they can tell you what crop might give you the best yield.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Now, the chamber has promoted stronger regional trade. And part of that is including closer collaboration with our neighbors like Guyana. Do you think that we can leverage our manufacturing expertise while partnering with countries that may have greater access to agriculture land?
Well, the short answer is yes. In fact, we have a member of our chamber who, we don't have enough coconuts. And so that what he does, he buys coconut water. In fact, he bought a large parcel of land with coconuts, and he extracts the water and brings it to Trinidad for resale, right? So we have already been using farms there. We also have farmers from central Trinidad who own rice land, and those produce, I don't want to call the names, it comes straight to Trinidad and they export throughout the region as well. So we already with Guyana, but having been to Guyana, and Guyana is extremely large, extremely productive in terms of the land, there was talk many years ago about doing some large farms in Guyana, and there was talk with the government. But again, what might be a lot more important for us though is to just get it done rather than talk about it. It sounds good, but I mean, the potential in Guyana is huge, and there's also a relatively large migrant population there as well. And they're legally, of course, and they could produce, they could give you some of the labor that is lacking, you know, within CARICOM. Ghana themselves, they are large producers of soya bean and rice and coconuts and a lot of things. In fact, even some of the companies that produce cooking oil here, they source their coconuts from Ghana and Malaysia. And guess what? We have on the southwestern peninsula, which is where I grew up, Cedros y Cacas, huge coconut estates, huge, and probably just one might be functional now because it was hit by disease. Of course, those individual coconut estate owners didn't have the crop dusters to spray it and get the locust out and the type of disease. Nobody helped them, and the trees died. So we, you know, and that was such a good industry. And then we started with the Atlantic LNG plant in Point and the working for LNG and those other companies in Point Fulton was a lot, it was paid more. So you find that the farms started to die. So we shouldn't allow farms to die. We should continue. We should, you know, make sure that we do what we have to do to ensure that we have that food security. It might not be as financially good as, let's say, the energy type industries. But for our food security, that's something that at the governmental level, we should really, really look at. And similar to what the US does, they their farmers, they are subsidized and throughout the world, you know, and it's for our food security. So, you know, that's my piece on that.
Mm-hmm. Now, Ms. Sokho, do you think that there are sectors, and let's take it beyond agriculture as well, that may offer some really good investment opportunities over the next 5 years?
For agro-processors, we're speaking about the...
No, outside of agriculture. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is agriculture show, but let's extend it beyond. Do you think there are specific sectors that would be useful for us to consider investment in over the next 5 years?
Sectors that, definitely. I mean, we could look at the whole idea of, Ballard would have mentioned it, there is the energy sector in terms of use of solar energy. That's one of the areas I think that could be looked at also. Even as AI is introduced more and more into businesses, it's becoming a necessity also. I think that improving the knowledge in terms of, you see, we could have so many new things coming in, and if we can now take it and create, okay, what is the next level for a business? What is the next level for a sector? It would be very important to basically, as I mentioned, to pull together what are the opportunities that's available. So I feel like the energy sector is something that could be looked at in terms of using solar energy. And even, well, I know you said beyond the agro-processors, but I feel like it's even important in terms of incorporating that as a key element in terms of, you know, how are you going to move forward with your business if it is in agro-processing. So
I saw an interview abroad that was speaking about certain sectors will become less important and certain sectors will mm-hmm. become more important. And what they're seeing is certain sectors like that provide blue collar type services, mm-hmm. looking mm-hmm. at electrician type work, pipe fitting. These are the types of sectors that they believe will have a boom over the next mm-hmm. 5 years. Welders. Because right now what they're seeing in the US especially is that there is a shortage, especially as they're seeing data centers and similar mm-hmm. being built aggressively over the next few years. They don't have enough workers that provide such services. Mm-hmm. And companies and people that are seeking to get into those sectors are the ones that are likely to thrive the most over the next few years.
Because those are really emerging. Those are what are emerging. So you mentioned even like electricians. So I still think you would need to have that person, that engineer, that person there, but then there's the technology that's now attached to that business or that way of doing that work. So yeah, I think there are a lot of emerging sectors, but emerging operational procedures, I should say, that will impact different sectors across the board, I think. So that the way of working is changing. The types of jobs are changing.
I tell you the truth, like sitting down and wondering about the emergence of and the potential for artificial intelligence in all sectors and the pace of growth. Mm-hmm. I would tell you personally, I have considered doing courses in electrical work or something just to try to safeguard myself over the next 3 years because it's never going to happen.
Thank you. Yeah, plumbers. So those vocational areas, you know, in schools back in the, you know, I don't know how much it was promoted, you know, but looking at it now, those are the ones that are actually the golden opportunities. So it's as though maybe you'll never be out of a job. So I'm not saying that the digital aspect is incorporated there, but the importance of having that person there. I think you're right. Yeah. You know, how do I upskill?
We recently, well, I think it's 2 years ago, we launched a website with, again, one of the members of our chamber. So he's into the security business. And what he did is interviewed those very electricians, air conditioned technicians, plumbers, carpenters, and so on. And on his website, there's a list of tradesmen that have been background checked. There are reviews on them. Their proper name and address is there. Mm-hmm. And the information that you will need rather than calling a plumber that you don't know. and you're wondering, you know, who stole the battery from your yard after and that sort of thing. So there is a website, I think it's called Better Business, and the Chamber pioneered that about 2 years ago. So for people in Central and even South, you can go to that website and you will find the people that you're looking for, and you will also get their pricing, and you will get reviews from people that they work for. As it relates to how do we diversify away from some of the other or do additional things, we have been having discussions with the Indian ambassador some time now, and the Indian High Commission, you might want to call him that. And so one of our guys from the board, he actually got a grant from the EU, I believe it's the EU, to produce syringes in Trinidad to supply to Trinidad and Latin America. We probably use more than 1 million syringes per year in Trinidad, right? So, but we do produce them here. So that's one of the industry, and some other small industries. We are having discussion as well with the pharmaceutical industry in India through the Indian High Commission, and where we could partner with those pharmaceutical companies. Now, bearing in mind, India is about 1,000 times larger than us, so we are very small compared to them. But one of the discussion would be centered around partnering with them using their technology for pharmaceuticals. And by the way, they provide about 60 to 70% of the pharmaceuticals in the world. And partnering with them so that we could actually do manufacturing using their certification that they have, do the manufacturing in Trinidad with their technology, and look at the wider Caribbean and Latin American market that's widely untapped. So those discussions we have been having, and there's also the Trinidad India Chamber, who would, you know, businessmen who might be interested, get in contact with us, get in contact with them. And we have meetings like these with the top pharmaceutical industries. And whenever there, in fact, there is something coming up with the pharma industry again. And we, the Indian High Commission, they will pay your hotel part of the airfare and accommodate, well, food and so on for about 3 days, I believe. And if you want to extend that, you pay the difference. But those are some of the linkages that, you know, if you contact the chamber, when those things come up, we could, you know, partake in those things and see how best we could actually fit in so that we could create a new group of industries in Trinidad. And most important, reduce our import bill and increase what we export, you know. But there's quite a lot of things that comes to us, you know. So we here could actually create the environment for our members to be part of it and to contribute in a good way to Trinidad development.
Now, one of the difficulties, especially I would say in the agro side of things, is access to financing. It is one of the biggest obstacles. Are there any changes that we could potentially see in financed institutions that could better support agriculture-based entrepreneurs?
All right. So the banking system, which I was a part of for quite a number of years, so I mean, the bank looks at risk and return. A lot, when you look at the default rate among farmers, it's usually a lot higher than all other industries. Simply because, in my opinion, the bank doesn't understand agribusiness. It might not carry a monthly installment because, listen, if you take $100,000 to plant tomatoes, you don't expect to make that money on a monthly basis for the next 5 years, right? So from month one, two, and three, you default already, right? Because you're not going to grow your tomatoes and sell it. And when you sell it in bulk. So for that crop that you take $100,000 for, you're ready to pay it out in 3 months and probably the interest only before you sell. So that the banks don't really understand agriculture. And given that, you know, it's really to please shareholders, I'm not sure that the bank will want to run into that. They have a social responsibility, yes, but the risk is way too high. And farmers are normally, they're not too technology savvy and that sort of thing. And you find a different group of people doing farming. So that, you know, the due diligence that the bank look for, you know, the state of readiness in terms of, the, you know, having a company and doing financials and so on and so on. Those are not things that people normally have in agriculture. So compliance is a is an issue. We have, though, we have NEDCO, that normally do the smaller type farming. And then we have the ADB. I know that they have been looking for people, the new government that is, to head those. I'm not sure if they that was done already. But they understand agriculture a lot more. And they should really come in the forefront and, you know, offer financing, but more than financing, training. Because, I mean, the average person who doing agriculture with, let's say, 5 acres of land, he doesn't even understand business too much, you know? And they have to understand the implications of not paying back. And the bank has to understand that, hey, if I'm going to plant corn or peas or carrot, whatever it is, it takes a certain time, you know, to source your material, to plant it, to grow it. And then, you know, there's no insurance or your flood hit you, well, you can't go back to the bank. That's the end of you. So that those are some of the things that, you know, ADB and NEDCO, for example, should really look into, so that the risk in itself to the farmers and the bank is reduced. And, you know, we level the playing field. People understand what ADB wants. They understand what NEDCO wants. And on the other hand, those institutions understand what the farmers' needs are. You know, and those things, I think over the years, we have not been able to really, you know, make it into a real business. In fact, years ago, I'm not talking about now, a lot of people, when a certain party won election, they got plenty of loans from NEDCO that they didn't have to pay back. Was it really for business? Probably not. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when we have an oil boom, we probably could hedge against those things. But if you really, really mean business, we got to do a lot better as it relates to funding for those farmers.
If I can add to what Balat is saying, one of the issues that I would have seen a lot of businesses have, small businesses, in accessing financing is the whole idea of compliance and documentation. So there are certain documents that a bank would request in order to measure their risk and to see exactly how they would evaluate this particular request. And if businesses are unable to provide the information, then in most cases they turn down, because in terms of tracking sales, for example, a lot of businesses, they don't really have like a something on Excel or so. They just maybe write it down in a notebook, you know. So again, the access to information to be able to pull together a document and a proposal for a banking institution or any other financial institution, it poses a difficulty for the business owners, simply because it's not a process or a procedure for them to follow through with. You know, so it's a little bit ad hoc in terms of the business, how the business is run. And that to me poses a serious issue or obstacle for a business to receive financing. And if I could just give one quick example, just after COVID, when the SME loan was being introduced by the then government, some clients I work with got through, and the ones that didn't, when I asked about what was the main point in terms of getting through with it, it's because they had all of their documents in place. I'm talking about sales reports and a business profile. A simple thing as a business profile, some businesses, micro, small businesses, do not have. So I think that's something that can be looked at also, so that the bank would have that information, you know, to process the request.
I think historically, farming was really about survival. It was not a hard job to get into, so that compliance, I mean, I too came, like I said, from the banking industry. And when the government did that grant and say, here's what you lend, I think it was about quite a few $100 million. Mm-hmm. The bank didn't lend half as much, mm-hmm. not because people didn't want, you know, but compliance was a major, major issue. I really do expect a farmer to pay NIS if unless we compel him to do so. And then when he goes to the bank, you can't get an NIS clearance, you can't get a tax clearance, you're not even registered, you know? So those are some of the things that we should, again, have a quantum leap if we are to get adequate level of funding. so that we could, you know, make sure that we compliant and all of those little things. Mm-hmm. I mean, we play our part. We help our members to get compliant. We have people mm-hmm. on the board and our members who provide that kind of service. But beyond that, you know, it's really a difficult one. We always say that we will do it, but the reality is it's not happening. And again, the bank, they have a social responsibility at the same time, but you're not going to give a loan where you can't have a clearly defined source of repayment mm-hmm. and you don't even have a repayment history. There's nothing really for the bank to go on. So I think the lead really should be like the EDB and NEDCO and those companies. Their risk return profile is quite different to that of the bank.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, the last question, because we're getting to the top of the hour, is that looking ahead, what does success in the agriculture sector look like over the next 10 years?
Hmm. Okay, so I was thinking the whole process of ethical production and procedures, you know, that should be top of mind again, and sensitizing the processors and the sector on the whole in terms of the importance of having ethical production standards. I think that is something that that should be looked at closely. Because it's for food security also, but also for safety and also to create a sustainable sector. So in other words, Trinidad and Tobago should be known for having very high ethical standards in terms of how our production standards are actually executed. And I think there needs to be that, not just a discussion, but I mentioned earlier, some sort of space where an agri-processor could actually go to, where they can get all of the information that is necessary to be able to set up their business properly, including of the compliance documentation and all of that, so that the ease of doing business could be, much improved for these agri-processors. And then Balad mentioned that the training aspect of it is important, because sometimes they just really don't know how to navigate, to actually set up a business, not just as a business, but what is your business model?
Yeah, for me, I think we should look at increasing or growing about 30% or more for food. Coming back to some of the things that Karina said, I'm affiliated with some of the hotel chains in the Caribbean as well. And what I know for sure, the issue that they have is that price and quality mm-hmm. starts off well for the first 3 months. If we take the Sanders Group, for example, they have a huge hotel chain. They import significant amount of foods, right? Fruits and vegetables. But they have to have a certain standard. And the prices can't be changing every week. So after about 3 months, that's the end of that. They have to now go to different countries and import their fruits and vegetables. Same applies to Trinidad, again, because it's subject to the weather and we do use a greenhouse type farm so that the quality and price is not as predictable. I think those are some of the things that we need to look at. And we have within CARICOM quite a lot of hotel chains, and most of them, in fact, the ones that I know, they import their things and not from CARICOM, right? Even eggs. I remember one hotel saying, well, just for our group, we need 30,000 eggs. And a lot of people never understood that 30,000 eggs per month is 1,000 eggs per day. Mm-hmm. And that's 1,500 square feet of land you will need to produce that. And so that, a lot of people, to show them what opportunities that are available to produce eggs with the proper, you need 1.5 square foot of land for a layer chicken. And you produce 30,000 eggs easy in less than a lot of land. Those are some of the things that people don't know, and it's very cheap. So, to end off, I know we just about time. price and quality is not consistent, and but at the strategic level, at our level, at a governmental level, once we stress upon that, I think Trinidad is in a really, really good position, even to buy produce within CARICOM and repackage to our standard, brand them properly, and the list could go on and on and on. But there's a huge market that we could tap into, provided that we, we fix the ease of doing business on the one hand, and that we understand that, whether it really can't affect the people we supply to, because they need a consistent price and quality.
Thank you so much for being part of Agribusiness Innovation. I really appreciate you both taking the time out, and of course, we welcome you back at any time. Listeners, this brings us to the end of our show for today. Thank you for joining us. Of course, I'll be here with you next week again for another edition of this show.
The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.